Hello, and welcome, dear listeners, to the second episode in our two-part podcast series about Hindustani music and emotions. Here, we will continue to talk about an exciting scientific research program focused on Hindustani music and the emotions it can evoke in people who listen to it. In our previous episode, we discussed the first study from Dr. Nandini Chatterjee Singh's research group on this topic. While only the responses from Indian listeners were used in that study, her group published a more recent study last year that used responses from an international set of listeners. This latest study was based on analyzing the responses from a total of 255 participants, divided into two groups based on whether they were culturally Indian or not. The enculturated group was composed of all the culturally Indian participants. All the other participants were termed as the non-enculturated group. The music in this study was the same as before, 3-minute-long audio clips of instrumental music, totaling 24 pieces, spread evenly between alap and gath playing modes in 12 ragas. The gath mode has a much stronger rhythmic component compared to the alap mode. But both modes of playing have the same tonality information in terms of the mix of major and minor notes being played that are representative of specific ragas. As I promised in the previous episode, we'll discuss some thought-provoking ideas connected with this work. We'll start with a look at the study's results, then we'll move on to the interesting ways in which prior work from other scientists connects with this research, and how it, in turn, could influence future research. We'll finish with some closely related international research developments, both in terms of other studies that show cross-cultural musical similarities and increased funding to pursue the medical and scientific possibilities in music. All through this podcast, you'll also get to hear some of the wonderful music used in the study. Yes, every piece of music in this podcast is part of the music around which the research is built. So let's get right to the heart of the matter. Did Hindustani music affect participants from Indian and non-Indian cultures in the same way? I really like the following line from the published study that asks the same question, but in a general sense. Does music penetrate cultural differences with its ability to evoke emotion? According to the researchers, the answer is yes, and to quite a high degree. Out of 192 comparisons of the emotion ratings between the enculturated and non-enculturated groups, the ratings differed in only 9% of the comparisons. This means, in more than 90% of the comparisons, the emotion ratings matched between enculturated and non-enculturated listeners. But wait, there's more nuance left in the data. Further analysis of the responses and the acoustic features of the music showed that for Indians, the enculturated group, variations in the tonality of different ragas determined emotion ratings more than rhythmic cues. For the non-Indian, that is the non-enculturated group of people, rhythm influenced emotion ratings more than tonality. So there seems to be a certain kind of cross-cultural difference when it comes to the relative importance of the tonality cues and rhythm cues that the listeners used to identify the emotions. It's important to remember here that tonality is present in both the alap and the gath. But the gath mode of playing the notes of the raga has a relatively greater rhythmic structure compared to the alap mode. The lead authorship of the study is shared between Vishal Midya and Jeffrey Valla. Unfortunately, Jeffrey passed away before the research was completed. The other scientists who contributed to this study are Himavati Balasubramanian, Dr. Avantika Mathur, who we spoke with in the last episode, and of course, Dr. Nandini Chatterjee Singh. The website collecting the responses is still the one that Dr. Suhas Vijayakumar built.
Because I do statistics a lot, I like to predict things.
Vishal Midya is currently working on his PhD degree at the Penn State College of Medicine in the United States of America.
So, I was doing my bachelor's in St. Xavier's College, Kolkata.
Okay.
I applied for this summer fellowship at Indian Academy of Sciences. And before applying also, I should say this, I was working in Jadavpur University.
Uh-huh.
So, there is a center called the C.V. Raman Center for Physics and Music. So, I was doing some small summer internship there, fellowship.
Right.
So I knew what was going on in India about music, and I saw some potential there. So then I went to Nandini's lab, and she was working with a lot of people at the same time. So the first year I was there, I was assigned to the dyslexia. The next year, I again applied and I went there because she was very nice. And
uh-huh.
It was a good experience there. So I went there again.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Then I started to work with Avantika.
Okay.
And then I was involved in this Hindustani music project. So the aim, we had a lot of data. The point data was collected and everything was there. And we have a lot of hypotheses there, but how to proceed,
uh-huh.
It was a very difficult thing. And
okay.
I was doing master's, so I started my master's then. I was doing my master's in Indian Statistical Institute in Delhi.
I see. During the course of his work on this study, he says that he gained a lot of on-the-job experience.
I didn't know much about statistics even then.
Okay.
Even now I don't know much, but
okay.
It was worse. So me and Avantika were completely clueless, what to do with this? This
okay.
is a huge dump data and a lot of variables.
Uh-huh.
So we started and eventually it took almost 4 years for us
okay.
to complete this.
That's very disarming to know that you learned a lot about statistics in the process of trying
yeah.
to break down this data set, right?
Right.
That's very nice to know. You know, for lay people, any scientist admitting that, they weren't good at something before, they learned it, did it, and became better and produced some scientific result in the process is sort of very jarring, I think. Because they're scientists have got to be awesome at what they do, right? And then everything happens. But
there are some times where we I have no idea what I'm doing.
Right,
I
right.
I study it and go through the process. The learning curve is always difficult.
But you have to make mistakes and then
exactly,
you find
exactly.
and then you correct yourself and you go forward. Vishal also helped me understand one of the most important parts of this study. How the participants were split into two groups, enculturated and non-enculturated. Given that the music used was Hindustani classical music, the enculturated group is made up of people who are likely to already be culturally exposed to the music, that is, Indians. In contrast, the non-enculturated group is made up of people who are confirmed as culturally not Indian. Cultural identity was assessed by a three-factor authentication system: current geographical location, country of origin, and native language. For the data used in the study, all of the enculturated group members were Indian in terms of their current location, country of origin, and native language. The exact opposite applies for most of the non-enculturated people. Although some of them were residing in India, they still had both a non-Indian country of origin and native language. Dependent as this research was on the work of multiple scientists, it was fascinating to find out that many of them were juggling this research with other projects, all while living and working in different countries and continents.
So the 2015 paper was mostly explorative, but there was some analysis.
Right.
And it was just beginning.
Actually. Right, it was the first time this whole idea was coming up.
Whole idea was coming up because you don't see studies like this, and it's costly and time-taking.
Right.
To be honest, to do a study like this.
I see.
The data was there, but then there are a lot of other hypotheses that we wanted to follow.
Right.
And that's where I come in the picture.
I see.
So I was a summer intern student. no clue, almost. And so I was there and I was asked to like work on the data. Yeah, and then we started to work on this paper around 2015 end. Avantika was leaving the lab. She was like wrapping up her project, PhD.
Right.
And I was not in the lab as such. I was there like, I did my master's and came to US for PhD.
Right.
So things were happening like through emails mostly.
Wow.
And like, I was doing analysis. Now Avantika came to US and she started a different work altogether, neuroimaging. Around that 2017 or 18 end, there was this postdoc from Cornell. He came to Nandini Ma'am's lab. His name is Jeff. So Jeff started to work with Nandini Ma'am on this paper, like write the manuscript, because the analysis was already there. So, and I was doing the analysis and everything was there and we were talking like back and forth, we were talking and working on this. And then sadly, in 2018, Jeff died actually.
Wow. Okay.
So, and then, so it was a sad event for us.
Right,
it was
of
like
course.
A very sudden event.
Uh-huh.
So at that point, I took the charge now because
I see.
Avantika was doing something else altogether.
Right.
Her research was something else. Jeff is not there. So I was like, okay, we have to do this. We have to finish this.
Uh-huh.
So then I took the charge and started to work on this paper full time almost.
I see.
And then Nandini Ma'am had an intern, Haima.
Uh-huh.
She helped me, obviously, and like a lot of things. I mean, Nandini Ma'am was also there
right.
by herself.
Of course.
And then we got some good ideas and eventually like the paper was done.
So let me get this straight. For a lot of the time when you were working on the second paper, you weren't even in the same labs, right?
No,
I mean,
it's completely different.
Yeah, it was an international collaboration for all intents and purposes.
Yes. I mean, Haima was in Germany.
Right.
I was here in the US. Uh-huh. I was in India. So we had these Skype chats and like WhatsApp calls and like weird times. And
wow, so
that's
okay.
That's why it takes some time, like, you know, doing all of this together, putting all of this together.
Right. Along with the fact that the data collection was on the internet. The whole work was on the internet.
If you think about it, there is a common thread running through what you could call the two halves of this study. How the listeners heard the music and gave their responses, and how the data was analyzed and written up for publication. That common thread is the internet, which makes such research and collaborative work possible. Funnily enough, even this audio podcast you're listening to is made possible because of the internet. Though, the casual way we say that one word, the internet, masks a lot of underlying complexity. Like the proverb about how, for want of a nail, the kingdom was lost, it's important to remember that a lot of minute and detailed work went into every aspect of all this research, and without which none of the results would have been possible. For example, collecting the listeners' responses through the internet was the most cost-effective and efficient way of going about the data collection. But that does not mean that it was easy to do. Dr. Suhas Vijayakumar, currently a postdoctoral researcher at Harvard University, reminisces about setting up the website where the music was played and the responses were collected.
Right. So I'm Suhas Vijayakumar. I studied a Bachelor of Science with Physics, Electronics and Math first in Bangalore in India. And then I went to National Brain Research Center to do my summer internship through Indian Academy of Sciences. And that's where I met Dr. Nandini Singh. So the main thing that you want from a website like this is to have the flexibility of presenting the music excerpts in a randomized order, because we don't want any spillover from a previous raga to the next one, and we don't want to capture mixed emotions, right? So if we can completely randomize the order in which we present these ragas, we are good to compare them. Along with these emotion ratings, we were also collecting some demographic data. So did they have any experience with classical music before? Have they heard Indian classical music before? Our main focus was to get a lot of the back end to work properly. Like, for example, randomizing the order of playing ragas, and collecting the responses immediately after playing ragas, or making sure that the participants listened to a certain amount of time while they were listening to these ragas, and they could not skip ahead and just randomly rate whatever they felt like. They had to listen to a certain duration first before they could go on to rate the emotions. So we wanted to have a lot of this back end thoroughly figured out.
Dr. Nandini also mentioned that there's a Hungarian version of this website, translated and set up by students from Hungary who were interested in contributing to the study. This explains the 62 Hungarian participants who gave their responses to the music. We've been talking about the music, its effects, and all the work based on it. But now, it's time we heard from the artist who made the music.
मेरा नाम है मुकेश शर्मा, मैं सरोद वादक हूँ.
My conversation with Pandit Mukesh Sharma was in Hindi, so I've taken the liberty of translating it into English.
सब जगह हमारा क्लासिकल म्यूजिक.
People all over the world should know and understand Hindustani music more. I am very happy when more research is done on Hindustani music, for that is when people will understand its richness.
तभी पता चलेगी लोगों को. मेरा नाम है मुकेश शर्मा, मैं सरोद वादक हूँ. मेरे पिताजी बहुत बड़े.
My name is Mukesh Sharma. I play the sarod. My father was the great sarod player, the late Pandit Rasik Bihari Lal. My gharana is the Senia gharana. For the last 40 years, I've been a practicing musician on the sarod and I've performed in many places.
मैं अपना निरंतर अभ्यास कर रहा हूँ, जगह-जगह परफॉर्मेंस करता हूँ.
तो आपकी. How did you come to meet Nandini ma'am and how did you start working with her?
आपने शुरू किया उनके साथ?
वो हमारे कॉन्सर्ट में आई हुई थी, तो उनको सरोद का प्रोग्राम बहुत अच्छा लगा. तब उस समय उन्होंने डिस्कस किया कि हम कुछ चाह रहे हैं कि.
She had come to my concert and she liked the sarod performance very much. After that, we discussed many things and she mentioned that she wanted to research on the 9 rasas or emotions. So we discussed a lot and basically there are the emotional flavors in music such as romantic love, comedy, wonder, heroism, peacefulness, compassion, anger, fear, disgust. These are the 9 emotional flavors. In addition to these, I added 2 more, parental love and devotional, which in total comes to 11. There are ragas that emerge from these categories of emotion and she wanted to know what the effect of these ragas was on people.
जो जो राग इसमें से निकलते हैं तो उसका क्या इफेक्ट पड़ता है लोगों पर. लेकिन उनका ये मकसद था कि आम आदमी पे इसका क्या इफेक्ट होता है.
This idea of emotions and the need to convey these to an audience informs both composition and performance in most kinds of Indian classical music and dance. As Dr. Nandini mentions, evoking emotions in their listeners seems to be the primary goal of Hindustani musicians.
All the musician is trying to do is create a certain mood and elicit a certain emotion. Everything else is secondary. That you happen to be telling a story of Radha Krishna, whatever, and all secondary. But the primary feature is to create the mood and create that emotional experience. So the person is going out to create that. Right. And his whole point is, if I'm not able to create this mood, I've been a total failure, which is very powerful in terms of a stimulus creation, you know, that I have the power to be able to influence somebody's mood to the extent that I can make him or her feel happy.
Now that we know more about the study's results, who worked on it, where the music came from, and how people could listen and respond to it, let's turn to how what was done in the study could be improved in the future. Firstly, this 2019 study is just as dependent on self-reported data from human participants as the 2015 study. So the merits and demerits of using self-reported data still apply. Please listen to our previous episode in this series for a detailed discussion of this issue. Secondly, while the participants were asked about their familiarity with Hindustani music, they weren't specifically asked about training. That's an entirely different dimension, thinking about training and how it affects a person's ability to parse emotional content from music. Not just the kind of learning that being part of a culture produces, for example, but musical training. Vishal Midya, the lead author of the 2019 study, talks about familiarity versus training and how they are definitely interested in exploring in future studies how training in Hindustani music might affect non-encultured people and their ability to distinguish its emotional content.
training on music. So if you are trained, probably, so we had, I mean, we didn't use training to be honest here in this paper, but that was our one of our aims, and probably we're gonna follow up on. So for example, if you are staying in US and you are born, brought up here, but then you are accustomed to Indian music, or you're trained, like, there are so many people like that. What happens then?
Right, yeah.
Right?
So that's a very interesting angle,
the
yeah.
Crossovers. What happened to those crossovers?
Right.
Things get messed up.
Is that part of the study to some degree because you're asking people how familiar they are with the music?
Yeah, we tried to control for the familiarity, but still, like, right. doing that training. So we didn't control for, we just asked, like, how familiar are you?
I see.
So even though after controlling that, we need to also know, like, how long did you train for?
Right. So, yeah, what does familiarity mean?
Exactly. What the familiarity means. So that probably one of the aspects that we should go into and see, like, okay, probably it's, so one of our hypotheses was like, people who are non-enculturated, training makes them behave like enculturated.
Thirdly, there's an extra tabla component in the gut that's not present in the alap. This is because the gut mode of Hindustani music requires a percussion instrument as accompaniment. But the tabla produces an extra acoustical signature that the listeners heard. Future research may try and figure out what impact the tabla has on the listeners' responses, or find a way to compare two modes of playing which both don't require a percussion accompaniment. This could be done by embracing the complexity of Hindustani music even more, and using modes of music that have strong rhythmic components but do not need a percussion accompaniment. Professor Bhishmadev Chakrabarty, a collaborator on the 2015 study by Dr. Nandini's group, talked about such modes of Hindustani music in the previous episode of this series. Future research could also remove the percussion sounds before the music is heard by listeners taking part in such studies. Dr. Nandini agrees that it might be worth it to try and remove the tabla sounds to get an idea of how much it may or may not be influencing the listeners. She also mentioned about her ongoing efforts to help other researchers replicate the work or build on it, by making it easy for them to access the music and the methodology.
It would be worthwhile at some point in time to replicate the study without the tabla.
Right.
And see whether the effects were just as strong. We had each recording as a separate digital channel. You could remove the tanpura, the tabla, whatever you want to. As a consequence, the stimuli can be used in any format you want to.
That those music files are now a resource you can dip into again and again.
And they're available on GitHub to the entire analysis as part of the Blossman paper.
Super.
And hopefully we will be able to create a little website so that we have all the details about the stimuli and people can use them for additional research if they want to.
Right. In the end, scientific research has always been less about perfection and more about the pursuit of what is possible at the very edge of our knowledge and abilities. It works because researchers constantly try to find better ways to dissect and understand complex phenomena. And each new research study seeks to answer the new questions provoked by previous studies. We're now at the perfect place in this podcast to explore some of the interesting connections between Dr. Nandini's research on Hindustani music and the studies published by other researchers. Firstly, the way Dr. Nandini's researchers measure tonality in a piece of music is based on previous research done on Carnatic music in a collaboration between researchers in Singapore and the United States of America. Carnatic music happens to be the major classical music tradition in South India, just as Hindustani music is the major classical music tradition in North India. For any fans of Carnatic music listening to this podcast, the link to this previous study is posted on our website. Secondly, in Dr. Nandini's research, the emotion labels used were based on finding common ground between how ancient Indian texts classify evoked emotions and how modern scientific research categorizes emotional responses to music. They compared the types of emotions mentioned in Indian texts like the Natya Shastra and the category system called Geneva Emotional Scale or GEMS in order to come up with the set of emotion labels or terms that the listeners participating in the study could choose from. Just for a moment, let's jump from music to dance. Other researchers have previously explored how emotion cues can transcend cultural barriers in Indian classical dance by comparing how Indian and American college students recognized intended emotions from dance expressions. The connection to Dr. Nandini's work is the common idea of testing cross-cultural audience responses to emotional cues in the performing arts. When it comes to finding connections between music and its relevance to people from various cultures, the 2019 study from Dr. Nandini's group had great company. Just 2 months after the 2019 study from her group, another set of researchers published a study that showed signatures of universality in music across human cultures. This international group of researchers, working as a collaboration across institutes in the USA, Canada, New Zealand, and Germany, showed that the musical features of songs that are sung, like pitch, tone, melody, and rhythm, can be used to predict social occasions or behavioral contexts during which they are sung across various human societies and cultures. Given that specific social occasions are associated with appropriate emotions and moods, the need to convey those emotions might very well be guiding the composition and performance of the songs. What sort of impact could Dr. Nandini's work have on future research programs? The website used for collecting listeners' responses in Dr. Nandini's study displayed two versions of all the emotion labels, in English and in Hindi, to better cater to the two groups of people whose responses were being collected. Dr. Nandini hopes that this will catch on as a common method employed in future studies that compare participants from different cultures, and she hopes to improve this system in her ongoing work in this area.
Well, I would love to, and I think now with the kind of things that Google Translate offers, what I would love to do is when the person is filling out the questionnaire and you know what the native language of the person is, whether following that one could offer the opportunity that would you like to rate emotions in your native language? You can ask that question and the person can make a choice.
Dr. Nandini's research has also been the first to incorporate the gut mode of Hindustani music in trying to see how non-enculturated participants perceive emotion in music. Previous studies have used only the alap. So Dr. Nandini's group has increased the modes of play that researchers can use from Hindustani music as they test what it can and cannot evoke in its listeners. Also, by establishing that Hindustani music can clearly elicit emotional responses in non-enculturated listeners, she has laid the foundations for Hindustani music to be used more broadly in research, and not just in cross-cultural studies of music and emotion. It could, for example, be used as a strong experimental tool rivaling samples of Western classical music to study medically relevant conditions like mood disorders. Dr. Nandini mentions how one of her friends opened her eyes to this possibility.
In fact, I had a very long and intense discussion once with a friend who was from the University of Trento, who wanted to begin to use these stimuli to try and look at mood disorders.
Okay. I see.
And say that maybe we can study this in a more careful way. And he went on later to work at Austria in a psychiatric department called Jans Scherbatz. And he said that it would be great if you could study this in mood disorders. And I was like, wow, that's something I never thought of. He says, no, well, the connections are so strong and, you know, you have specific ragas for specific things. It would be great to try and study that. And now more and more people are beginning to do that.
And let's not forget how scientific evidence for the emotions that different ragas and modes of play can evoke will serve as a strong support for standardized testing and the use of Hindustani music as a possible therapeutic or management tool for neurological and psychiatric conditions. Whether it's emotions, socially and culturally important situations, or medicine, music seems to find its way into so many things that are fundamentally important to us. Take, for example, how in our previous episode, Dr. Nandini talked about a connection between sung speech and autism. the music of vocal singing, when incorporated into everyday speech, was somehow affecting how autistic children pay attention. As it turns out, that is hardly the only situation in which music can help people overcome previously insurmountable hurdles. There's also something very peculiar that happens when music meets another neurological condition called aphasia. We found out about this from a scientist who is not from India, but has a very special connection to the country and its people. Let's listen to what Dr. Thomas Bach has to say.
To explain, the background, So my main area of research is in fact language. And I visited Dr. Singh in Manesar and gave a talk there and so on, and I'm familiar mainly with work on language and particularly on alphabet and literacy.
Right, got you.
Because, so that's how I come in.
I see.
My main interest, I would say, for the last 30 years has been language in the brain. I did my PhD on aphasia, on language disorders caused by brain diseases, mostly stroke, but not only. Then I worked for many years in Cambridge on the relationship between movement, cognition, language, so language and movement disorders. And over the last, I would say, maybe 5-6 years, here in Edinburgh, I've been focusing mainly on bilingualism, multilingualism, how this influences brain function. So in fact, I have several studies from India, including, I think about 10 that I did mainly with my colleague Suvarna Aladi from Hyderabad, now she moved to Bangalore, and we showed that basically people who speak more than one language develop dementia much later, recover better from stroke, had a more mild form of aphasia after stroke, and so on, so on. So there's a whole series of papers.
Right.
Language and music are kind of sibling, and that became very clear to me already, doing my PhD on acute aphasia. So when you find out, if you look at the history of aphasia, that going back to 17th, 18th century, there are descriptions of so-called dissociations, people who got a stroke, lost their language, but still were able to sing or to recite hymns. So this is, in fact, some of the oldest description, going back to, Germany, Sweden, and so on. I think one is Dolin, kind of 1740. So really, going to the
first
solution, where they describe what a strange case. Someone had a stroke, could not really speak, but could still recite psalms. Very often, they were religious texts. But, like in India, of course. Traditional Western music until the 20th century was very much religious music. But going back to aphasia, so they observed that patients could still recite, and they were trying to use this recitation to communicate.
I see.
And based on that, many centuries later, so in kind of 1960s, 70s in Boston, a musical intonation therapy was developed for aphasia, in which patients are taught, so to say, to sing a sentence if they cannot say it.
I see.
So you have basically the idea that, you are not able to say something, but if you sing, you can suddenly speak. It sounds surprising because you add additional level of difficulty. But the idea probably is it might activate more the right hemisphere, which is, so to say, still better preserved and so on. It might activate also more the kind of basal ganglia, deeper subcortical structures, automatic, processing. So it works in stroke patients. It's one of the well-established aphasia therapies.
I see.
So there is an intimate connection in this case, and as I say, music has been used.
After hearing about all the different ways in which music can affect us, it comes as no surprise that in September 2019, the National Institutes of Health in USA announced grants totaling $20 million over a period of 5 years to support research projects that are working to understand how music could be used to treat a range of medical conditions, including neurological disorders. These research projects are spread across conditions like autism, Parkinson's, and Alzheimer's disease, not to mention the work on how music could affect stress levels, immunity, and brain development. As part of all these and other projects, every day, more researchers are working on scientifically studying music and unlocking its potential to change our world for the better. Without Dr. Nandini's help and introductions to her colleagues, this behind-the-scenes podcast series would not have been possible. Thanks are due for this episode to Vishal Midya and Pandit Mukesh Sharma, as well as Drs. Suhas, Avantika, and Thomas, who contributed their valuable time to answering our questions. I'm sure that in appreciation of the music you've heard in this episode, you will join me in thanking Himavati Balasubramanian, an erstwhile student of Dr. Nandini's, who provided InSciComm with all the study's music samples, and musician Pandit Mukesh Sharma for his skill at cajoling such beautiful melodies out of his sarod. As was the previous episode, this is an InSciComm production. Dr. Nandini's acquaintance with Dr. Shruti Murlidhar, a co-founder of InSciComm, provided the spark for creating this series. On our website, we have links to various aspects of Dr. Nandini's research, her group's 2019 and 2015 study, as well as the website that Dr. Suhas made, which is still functional and ready to collect more data. If you're interested, go to that website and see what the fuss is all about. If you need a reason to contribute your responses, think of it as putting some of your emotions into a scientific time capsule. InSciComm proudly hosts a list of Indian women neuroscientists who are in faculty positions at various research institutes in India. This database, called NeuroFem India, provides a glimpse into the wide variety of research topics that these scientists work on. Of course, Dr. Nandini Chatterjee Singh is one of these scientists. Interested listeners will find NeuroFem India 2019 under the Databases tab on our website, insciComm.blog. It has been an absolute pleasure to work on this podcast, mixing the various ingredients of the story into what I hope has been an audible confection. On behalf of InSciComm, this is Abhishek Chari. Explore more of our SciComm podcasts on all major podcast distribution channels like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, etc., etc. And our SciComm work in other media is available through our website, insciComm.blog. Thank you very much for listening.